Hello everyone, Dr. Sam Manger here, and thanks for joining me on another episode. So today, got Dr. Michael Tam, who's GP, Senior Lecturer at the Discipline of General Practice, University of Sydney, and founder of evidencebasedmedicine.com.au, which is the proper name is Morsels of Evidence, Evidence-Based Medicine for GPs. So perfect person for the job today. So thanks so much for joining me, Michael.
Pleased to be here, Sam.
Now, this is a topic that a lot of people have asked me to do, so talking about evidence-based medicine in the sense of its application in general practice, how people can find the time and how people can analyze trials, because there's so much evidence now coming out. There's so many trials of varying qualities, and it's getting pretty hard to tell the difference between, you know, good and bad. And there was an interesting 2012 paper from the British Journal of General Practice talking about the barriers, you know, and the time, the money, the skills, but also just patient expectations and potentially not really understanding evidence themselves. So a lot of difficulties now, along with every other difficulty that we have to deal with as general practitioners. So how do you sort of approach this? You know, when you hear like an investigation or a new treatment on the horizon, how do you approach, what's your process and resources you use?
Well, look, there's, so one of the things that, you know, when I sort of speak to sort of junior doctors about evidence-based medicine, you know, there is the, possibly part of the medical training as well, is that we just feel like we just need to know more, like, you know, read more. Look, there's all this stuff coming out. How do we take it all in? Maybe I'll read some more. Maybe I'm not a good enough person. Some version of that. Just, you know, it's been described as, you know, drinking from the fire hose. And I think fundamentally, we just have to accept that EBM cannot be done by trying to stay up with the literature, insofar as reading all there is to read, or being trying to absorb all there is to know, on the expectation that maybe one day you'll see a patient where that little bit of knowledge is relevant. So, so that's it's just not possible, and I don't think it's there's no benefit in pretending that that is possible, because it's basically not. And and really, it's the first step to understand that that actually can't be the process. That you know, having a whole bunch of journals, you know, in general practice, we don't even have just disciplinary journals we can rely on. You know, a lot of the stuff that's going to be relevant to general practice, maybe in a surgical journal, might be in an ED journal, maybe in a medicine journal, maybe in sort of a journal in another country. And so we just have to accept that that cannot, in fact, be the way to do it. And so, and one of the things is that that is okay. You know, that is actually okay. It is the way it is, and it's actually okay. And part of the reason I think that it is okay is that the way that evidence is generated and created is that the majority of the material doesn't actually change clinical practice. Now, it doesn't mean that the papers which are published are useless. It's actually that most new stuff that comes out forms the foundations of knowledge, but may not directly actually influence what we might do specifically with our next patient, or it may not make a big difference to the next patient. So I think, firstly, it's not to be worried that we're not reading, you know, every single copy of the MJA or of AFP and not staying up to date, and that's actually okay. And I think rather what is more important is when we do see our patients, so, you know, interactions with patients and their issues and their problems in their context, is when we get to decisional points, when we get to problems where we may not have an answer, and that would, I would imagine that should happen commonly. How is it that we are able to find the best evidence that may meaningfully influence that person's care? And I think so. Really, the first step of evidence-based practice is not knowing which journals to read or how do I organize my time, because that's a lost cause for the most part. The first and most important step is being able to generate meaningful questions from the clinical care we're actually providing to our patients. So if I see Mrs. Jones, she comes in with a particular issue, we talk about a whole bunch of stuff, but there may be a specific decisional point. Now, that might be, should I or should I not use this new drug, new intervention, which I might have heard about in on the news, or maybe there was something in Medical Observer or OSDA or some other sort of general media that, that we doctors will come in contact with. How is it that I be able to find information relevant to this person in front of me in terms of whether or not it is the thing to do or not? And what question do I need to ask? Because, you know, if a new intervention comes out, we could ask endless questions about it. Now, does it work for this? Does it work for that? Well, the side effects for this and that. And but the issue is, for the person in front of me, what question should I actually be asking, and having a question that's actually answerable. And then once we have the question, we can actually make a search then of the evidence. And that really is the next step. So if we're able to generate a question, then we're able to potentially use tools to search for an answer to that question. And there are skills related to the search. And one of the things about using evidence-based, making use of evidence-based medicine, is we're not doing research per se. We don't have to do a systematic, you know, review of the question we're asking. Really, we want to be pragmatic. You know, where is the best evidence likely to be had? What is the best sort of evidence for this sort of question? What's out there? And if there's a answer in a reasonable form at a high level of evidence, well, that's probably going to be reasonably good. If you can't find anything, that's often meaningful in itself, especially if you're pretty confident about your a pragmatic search thing. If there's nothing that you can find,
that's indicative. Yeah.
It probably means that nobody is really sure. And again, that tells us something, that whether or not, you know, you look at the lower grades of evidence about what that particular concept is, how much should that information actually influence your clinical decision making is often a little bit questionable. And so from the perspective of using evidence for clinical care delivery, often that actually then at that point doesn't matter so much. It's some of the other issues, some of the other contexts, which perhaps are more important than the specific empirical aspect of the intervention, that will make a decision on whether you go with it or you don't go with it, or the setting in which you would do the intervention.
So that's, I like that as a really good first point, because it's sort of a change in paradigm as well, at least to some people who, you know, we do medical school and then we do GP training or any specialist training or allied health training. And there's this sort of idea that you kind of have to know everything. You're supposed to be the god of all knowledge, you know, and we should sort of dispel that myth early on for our own mental health and probably our own humility and egos, is that no, today's, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something like thousands of scientific papers being published every week. It's impossible to keep up to date with that. So we find what is guided by our clinical practice and what's relevant. And then, you know, have, as you say, a question that has hopefully an answer, but may not have an answer, and that's indicative of itself. So when you have that question and you go through a search, what's your process, you know, when you want to write up an article or whatever it is, in how you actually search? I mean, I'm assuming you use a little bit of Google, but I'm assuming there's a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think the number actually is 2.5 million papers are published every year. So
every year, there you go.
No, it's extraordinary.
It is. It's a beautiful thing in its own way. I mean, it's great that we're advancing at that level, but to keep up to date with that's pretty difficult.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So look, in terms of, let's say I've got a question. So the sort of the articles I write for the website are generally based on real patient scenarios. Now, some of the scenarios may not be an actual single patient. I might roll a bunch of different patients into one. Now, I don't want to potentially sort of identify with my patients, obviously, and I may come with name. But now, once I have the question, the next step with the search is really sort of understanding where is the best. Like, you know, if let's say it's an intervention question. Usually I look at an intervention type question. So when I say an intervention question, it might be, does this treatment do X? You know, person has condition Y, that have that context. If I give them this intervention, does it have a meaningful benefit of some meaningful health outcome? That's an intervention type question. And it's an important empirical question, because if we're telling a patient, oh, you should do this because this is going to happen to you, well, we probably need to really have some basis to say that. We're giving the patient some sort of predictive future about what's going to happen.
You'd hope so. That's kind of our job.
That's right. And obviously, that's not the only thing that matters to the patient. But now, if we're going to say that to someone, then there should be some rationale on why we're saying it. And for an intervention type question, you know, there are different types of evidence. And, you know, if we want to cut to the chase, we probably just want to see, does the best type of evidence for that sort of question, does it even exist? And for most intervention questions, that's going to be a systematic review of randomized trials. So it's an intervention question. So if the first step probably is, does a systematic review of a randomized trial of the specific question I'm asking, does that even exist in the first place? Because if it does exist, there's probably not much point going through individual studies, lower quality evidence, because in terms of sort of the a pyramid of quality of evidence, you're going to pay most attention to what is the best quality evidence first, and then, you know, maybe drift down the pyramid if you don't find it. So my approach then would be, I would have a look at the Cochrane database, so the Cochrane Library, Cochrane database of systematic reviews. Do they have a systematic review on that topic? Now, sometimes the answer is yes, and over time, as more reviews are being created, particularly for common sort of questions, something will exist, and that's great. Now, sometimes the Cochrane review may not be the most up to date. You know, if it was published quite a few years ago, I might have a look to see whether there's something newer. But if there's already a systematic review that exists and it's pretty good, generally what you're going to do next is there a updated review? Is there a newer systematic review that takes account of all the evidence that was in the existing one, and any new research that has been done is now fit into it? Sometimes there isn't. The Cochrane review is the newest. Sometimes the Cochrane review may explicitly state, hey, you know, we've done this review, but the state of the evidence is not so great. It's pretty bad. Now, in that setting, you might want to look to see whether or not a very definitive randomized trial was done since then. Again, the odds that has happened is often not particularly high. So I'm not terribly surprised when I don't find something. Now, if a Cochrane systematic review does not exist, which is not uncommon, the next step I would usually take is that I use a specific EBM search engine. So this is something that might not be that familiar with a lot of clinicians and a lot of GPs. There's a search engine called TRIP database. That's TRIPdatabase.com, I think. So TRIP stands for Translating Research into Practice, and it's a really neat search engine. And one of the cool things with the TRIP database is that you can do a search in terms of, you can do something called a PICO search. So PICO, P-I-C-O, that's a potential way of framing some EBM sort of questions. So P stands for participants. So you sort of work out who the group of participants you care about is, and presumably that's going to be someone like your patient. What is the actual intervention you want to look at? What's the appropriate comparator group? And what's the outcome of interest? And you can actually, on the TRIP database, actually just put those four things in. And you don't have to put something in. So very often for if I'm doing a search, maybe the outcome of interest, I choose not to put something. I'll just leave it blank because I'll be happy to see any study that just included the participants' intervention and some comparator. Understanding, of course, you know, for a lot of questions, it's not like you're going to be seeing, you know, thousands of studies. You know, at best, you might just see a small few. So often, I wouldn't leave some things blank because I'm not looking at a large number of results anyway. And what the search engine will do, it will give you a search output that will list out any systematic reviews that exist that sort of meets that criteria. It will list out potential primary evidence, so that could be trials, but it will also search out pre-appraised sources of evidence as well. So for instance, my website is indexed on TRIP database, so if you happen to search a question that is addressed in one of my reviews, that will come up on the search engine. And
you're famous.
Well, not so famous, I think. But potentially, you know, it will come up. And there are a whole bunch of other good websites. So, for example, there's Best Bets. They make quite a few reviews, so evidence-based reviews, where someone's taken the time to go through a question, look through the literature, have a think about it, appraise it, and then synthesize a response to the question. And this is the thing with EBM. You don't necessarily, from a pragmatic perspective, why necessarily go through all the steps if somebody else has already done it for you and also published it?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the pragmatic way is to use it. And, you know, if you were really interested, maybe you would make sure that what they did was okay. But, you know, there are certain sources which are fairly trustworthy. And one of the reasons I look at a Cochrane database is their systematic reviews are usually pretty exhaustive and they're pretty much okay. If there's a problem with a review, it's probably not because of methodology. It's because there's something missing in the evidence in the published literature. And I suppose at a certain sense, we can't do very much about that as users of the evidence. So I really like Trip Database. For the purposes of my website, obviously I don't make use of other people's synthesized evidence. I do it myself. But if I was using it as a clinician, if I had a question, I wanted to search for something, that's what I would do. I would have a look at it. Oh, looks Best Bets has a pretty good answer for this question. Have a look through it. Yeah, it seems pretty reasonable. That's okay.
Yeah.
And that's a much better way of using the evidence for a patient-generated question than trying to have potentially read thousands of papers and just so happen to have read enough of the primary evidence that would allow me internally to be able to answer that question from my memory. And of course, the reality is I'm not going to remember it. I'll forget that I've ever read the thing, or I'll have some misinterpretation or a recollection error about what the study said anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that's really useful. Really useful resources. Thank you. One of the things, and this is a tangent a bit, but I often find that patients that come in with articles that, you know, because if you Google anything these days, I really think this has changed in the last few years, even the years that probably the last three even. But it used to be if you Googled something like, I don't know, glucosamine or something, and you would probably get a few decent websites, and then you get the sort of health bloggers and sort of more, questionable analysis after that. But now it's like the first three pages of Google are just like junk, basically, it's actually getting really hard for the general population to know, which is why there's so much confusion, which is why there's so much pressure on GPs, and which makes our job harder. But at the same time, it makes us be better, I think. So that's a good thing as well. But sometimes for my patients, I'll say, look, next time you look up something, just type in what you want, like glucosamine osteoarthritis, and then type in PubMed or evidence after that. And I find that almost always gets rid of all the junk and brings up all the relevant stuff, like either the guidelines or the actual PubMed papers themselves. And whilst that's a much more layman's way of approaching, I often find it can be helpful for people.
Yeah. And I think, look, it's actually great that patients are feeling are empowered and actually having tools where they can actually look stuff about themselves. And I think part of increasing the role of doctors is actually how do we support patients in their self-efficacy in looking up that information. Because, they meet me for, 15, 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. And how much do I really expect that they're going to
sink in? Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
what I said. There'll be a primacy effect. Now they'll remember what I said at the beginning. There'll be a recency effect. They might remember some message I said right at the end, but all the stuff in the middle, who knows how much is actually taken in? While there are good resources out there, and for patients, often they're not necessarily looking for a single specific question. I might have a very single specific question, but for a patient, and they might really be looking more for a good overview. So let's say glucosamine. They say, someone says glucosamine, they see it on the shelves, should I take it or not? So in their mind, should I take it or not is a very general question, but within that, they have a whole bunch of other questions, some of the things they've never even thought about until they know about the topic in a little bit more depth. And this is where I think there are good resources. I think Better Health Victoria, they've got some good basic, topic guides effectively for patients. If it's sort of in a field of, let's say, sexual health or contraception, Family Planning New South Wales, they've got a whole bunch of good patient handouts. And they're handouts which are sort of designed to be readable and understandable by the lay public. And they're not answering perhaps very specific questions. They can't be, but they sort of give a good enough general overview that people have an understanding of what's going on. And hopefully when they see me, they're asking questions which are now actually pertinent to them in specific ways, as opposed to a generic, well, should I take this or not?
Yeah, for sure. No, I 100% agree with you. I think this is the way medicine and clinical practice is evolving. It's not about this paternalistic model. This is changing, so that it's about shared management, in the sense that, okay, you're now becoming, these chronic diseases are so complex and unique to a person's lives that we should be, in a way, improving health. People's health literacy, and their EBM literacy, so that they can, with our support, go and do some research themselves. It's just that we want to give them, here's some basic ways to use the internet to find some quality data. Just be aware of these things. And, you said Better Health Victoria. I think it's patientinfo.co.uk. I find a very good one for patients. So yeah, as you say, they're out there. So when we're ourselves looking at trials and papers, what's your process for assessing whether this is, a good one or a bad one? I mean, one would assume that a systematic review is generally good, but I think your PICO example is great because you want to make sure your patient group is relevant, your control group is relevant, intervention group is relevant, outcomes relevant. But how else do you analyze data?
So I think I suppose I'll raise a scenario, because my registrar sometimes do this, they heard about a paper, there's to be something reported in the medical media, new paper published in the in NEJM, New England Journal, and it says this, we should all be changing our practice now. So that happens. So sometimes there'll be a paper which comes out which captures people's attention. In other places, maybe a drug rep brings a bit of advertising and says that.
That's a big one.
Here's a paper, says that, have a chart there, and you think, oh, well, maybe I'll look at the original paper. So people think in those terms. And I think one of the most important things we can actually do before we even dive into reviewing an individual paper is again asking ourselves why we're doing it. Are we doing it for a knowledge about the topic, a knowledge about the question, or is it, do we want to learn something about the specific experiment? Because these are actually two very different concepts. Because if we are more interested about understanding the evidence behind the question, the first thing we need to know is this paper even the best paper to inform me about this question? And often the answer to that is no, it's not. Because you see it not infrequently. There'll be a paper that gets blown out of proportion, might be a little bit unfair. But obviously, as a researcher, I often like people to talk about my papers when they come out. But whether it's the most important paper in the field is questionable. And so I remember, I think a few years ago, there was a talking about glucosamine, I think a paper that came out that said glucosamine in that paper showed something or other. It was a cohort study, and there was a commentator saying, "Oh, look, maybe there's some evidence for glucosamine to do for knee osteoarthritis or whatnot." And the problem, of course, is it's a cohort study. In the context, we have really high quality systematic reviews of randomized trials. This new study may have some interest from an experiment perspective, but in terms of whether this new piece of evidence particularly changes the way we think about the question they tried to answer, well, the answer is not really, no, because there's actually higher levels of evidence. So I think the first thing when we actually want to analyze, why do we actually want to analyze it? Is it because we want to know about the question that's being asked, or is it a specific focus on this particular paper, this specific experiment? There's something about this paper we want to look at. Now, very often, I think from the clinical perspective, from the practical perspective of providing patient care, we probably actually don't care that much about the specific experiment. We actually care more about the empirical evidence in general in terms of how it applies to our patient. And so, again, back, what is the question that's being asked? Do a search. What's the best evidence that exists? How does this new bit of new publication fit into that general schema? And it might not fit terribly well. Okay, maybe it's interesting this got published, but there's all this other stuff. This probably doesn't particularly change much. We can look at it, but if there's a if this new paper says something that's very, very different to what the established higher quality evidence says, you have to sort of take it under advisement, and it probably shouldn't directly change clinical practice. Mm. Now, sometimes you do the search and this is the best paper. Great. Okay, so this paper will answer the question and you should review it. Or sometimes the existing evidence was terrible. So this is a situation, there's been a systematic review before, but pretty much everything in it was pretty hopeless. And this is actually a new seminal trial. This is the reason why this trial actually exists. And that's pretty useful. So I suppose once you've made a decision that's even worth, I think, looking at the paper, in terms of if you want to do a critical appraisal process, what I would normally suggest is perhaps not do what I remember from medical school, sitting in sort of journal clubs where people just tear paper to bits because they don't like the conclusion of it, is not to look at the results first up. You need to look at what question was asked and what was the methodology. A really good way to do that is to not just do it on gut intuition, but to make use of some worksheets. There are some really good worksheets available from the Center of Evidence-Based Medicine. So this is out of Oxford University. So if you just Google Center of EBM Oxford, you'll go to their website. They've got a whole bunch of tools, and some of those tools include worksheets for doing critical appraisals for different types of studies. So for therapeutic trials, like randomized trials, for systematic reviews, for other sort of studies, for example, if you're looking at prevalence type studies, they've got different worksheets for different types of studies. And a good thing about the worksheet is that it just forces you to go through some particular questions. So rather than getting, I suppose, lost in trying to think through and wade through a paper, there are some specific questions that it asks that you look at, and it tells, and on the side, it sort of tells you what you're particularly trying to look at, why it's important, and what's those things you might want to, might consider. And initially you look at the methodology first. So there are a number of methodological questions. For instance, whether the trial was randomized, and what sort of randomization was done, whether the measures are objective, or whether or not blinding occurred. So there's a whole bunch of questions which are done. And the idea is those questions give you a sense on whether it is likely that the study is biased in some significant way. And if there are some major concerns about the internal validity of the study, again, the question is, do the results really matter? So whatever the results say, it looks like it's going to be pretty biased. Sure, look at the results, but you're going to take them with a grain of salt. And what you're doing then is you're looking at how the study was run, actually looking at just particular bits of the results which matter to you, not necessarily being guided by what the authors might have said in their abstract or in their conclusion, and you sort of make your own judgments based on the sort of question you actually care about. It is not uncommon for there to be some pretty major internal validity problems with a lot of studies. And instantly, that doesn't mean the study is terrible or it needs to be written off, but does mean that whatever results come up, sure, there's a result there, but I've got some uncertainty about it. And again, you have to then take that into sort of advisement in terms of what you might then do about that result when it comes to the point of patient care, which ultimately is what matters. You're reading this presumably as a clinician, not for your own intellectual interest, what you might be, but in terms of where it has an impact on the health system is its application in real patient care.
Yeah, that's really useful. So just to sort of try and summarize it a little bit, I mean, you brought up a lot of really important points, and in a way we're kind of going back to basics here, but it is kind of important to do. You mentioned the pyramid, you know, the hierarchy of trial design, I suppose. And you know, just for everyone listening, obviously, we know we've got our case studies, and then you've got your cohort, retrospective and prospective, and then randomized controlled trial, then meta-analysis, and et cetera, and then you know, guidelines fit, can either take one or more of those and can be on the side somewhere. And then you've got your, you know, size of the trial, your effect. And one of the things I think can often slip up some people is the journal. And obviously, you know, there are obviously really good journals in theory like Lancet and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But because sometimes when they're on PubMed, they all look similar because they're all in the same PubMed format. But when you actually go and look at the little journal, it says like Journal of, I don't know, complementary therapy or something. I mean, I don't want to give anyone any stick, but you know, like just some trials that you think, okay, this, there may be an inherent philosophical bias within that journal. And so, as you say, you've always got to keep in mind that there could be a bias. And that brings me to, it's a huge, huge thing in a podcast in itself, but I mean, are there any things that you, when it comes to bias, that you really sort of watch out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I suppose, you know, it's an interesting thing you raise because, you know, obviously there's all these so open publishing type journals now, and some of them you wonder, you know, at their rigor. And of course that's not necessarily an issue if the authors were, all authors were scrupulously honest, but you know, you question that as well, you know,
why yeah.
stuff get published in some of those journals if they're actually good. No, good studies. Most good studies probably could get published in a reasonable open source, you know, open journal if it was actually okay, if it could survive peer review. So there are some questions, you know, when something gets published in something that you know that the journal is pretty dodgy, and I'm not sure if it's available anymore now. There used to be a US librarian, John Beale. I think he had a list of predatory journals. Normally, I would just assume if something was published there, there's probably a problem with it.
Yeah.
Though, you know, that's purely just a heuristic. You know, there might be nuggets of gold in there, as far as I know, but they got published in there, it might be problematic. I'm not entirely sure whether Bill's list is up anymore, so it's a little bit more challenging now. Look, that is a factor. I don't necessarily discount something just because it's there. I sort of let the study speak for itself. And often studies which have undergone very poor pre-review or they were problematic to begin with, it usually shows up, I think, in the publication anyway, if you actually go through the methodology. So this is, again, I practically just pay no attention to the conclusions that the author draws from their study, look at sort of their method, look at what their outcome actually was, and I sort of make my own decision on that, assuming, of course, they didn't lie.
Yeah, great. And that brings to another point that you made, which is a really nice sort of pearl, I suppose, is that as tempting as it is to just look at abstracts, do look at the paper itself, because as you say, they're often being, and often subgroups in there that you may miss that might be actually more relevant to your patients, and that maybe the overall finding was there's no effect or an effect, but in a subgroup, it may be actually much more relevant or much less relevant. So you can get a lot from doing that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, absolutely. I think making conclusions by reading the abstracts, and I can absolutely understand why that happens. You know, sometimes a thing is hidden behind a paywall somewhere, and look, sometimes you don't feel like reading it, you know.
Yeah.
The abstracts are often misleading. They're often misleading. I think the best way to think about an abstract is it just allows you to have a sense, is it even worth looking at it? Like, is it about a topic that's relevant, because you know you don't want to have to go through a paper then to discover that, oh, actually this isn't even about the intervention I'm interested in. So the abstract gives you a sense of whether or not it's something that might be useful, but the certainly the conclusion, you can practically just ignore the conclusion. You really need to draw your own conclusion.
Okay, so thank you. So that's great. Obviously, this is one of those topics that people do PhDs on and could spend years talking about this. So we've got to sort of cover it somewhere. But I wonder, one of the things, you know, I mentioned right at the beginning that one of the barriers to GPs is patient understanding expectations. So I was wondering if if you were happy to, explaining, like, how do you explain the difference to patients in trials when it comes, let's say, to a therapeutic effect of the difference between relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction, like what's relevant to the patient? Because often pharmaceutical reps will tell, oh, look, it's a 20% absolute risk reduction. You're like, wait a minute, no, it's like a 0.1%.
Yes. So, yeah. I think, you know, one of the things with the risk communication is that it is intrinsically challenging, where humans are not good, I think, at thinking about mathematics, especially mathematics, not from a concrete counting way, percentages and probabilities. They're hard to understand. Like, you know, if I told you, you know, you had a 1% reduction in something or other, can you actually internally feel intuitively what that actually means? You know, like, you might say yes. So, but you probably don't actually.
Yeah.
And so, look, it is a very difficult thing. And I think what we need to do is, or at least what I try to do, I'm not sure how successful I am, is to try to understand the person and have it convey to them the way that would be most meaningful for them. Now, for some people, it might be actually avoiding numbers altogether, that it's actually not a useful way of actually discussing it, particularly when we start talking about very small risks. Like, you know, it's a 0.5% versus 0.25%. Does anyone really know what that means? No, I'm not sure, you know. And to really talk about, you know, what are things which are important to them, and then once you have an understanding of what sort of things are important, to describe, I think, the numbers in a sort of a concrete, naturalistic way. So, you know, if 1,000 people did this, this is what happened. This is what number would happen to them, to describe it in sort of natural frequencies. But if you had this intervention, and 1,000 people had this, this is the number that would be what would happen to them. And you know, there are some potential good decision aids that use that sort of format, where they have sort of a diagram where there'll be little people, some people coloured one colour for this, another coloured for the outcome, another colour that got avoided the bad outcome. So I think that natural way of speaking about numbers, sort of in absolute terms, is probably the way that's best understood by patients, though that doesn't work for everyone. No, some people they're just not visual thinkers in terms of proportions. I think relative risk reduction, I know we tend to poo-poo it a little bit. It is actually quite a intuitively understood thing. So if you told someone that that, you know, if you did this, you know, you stop your smoking, you halve your risk, people sort of get what that means. The problem, of course, is they may not understand what that means for them in their context, because that's really about absolute risk. So the problem with using sort of relative risk is that you tend to inflate small effects. You know, if you told someone you took this statin, you reduce your risk for a heart attack by a quarter, that sounds fantastic, right? But of course, you know, if their absolute risk before was 1%, you know, it's a 0.25%, you know, it's 1 in 400 people, you know, that doesn't sound quite as good anymore. But I think, you know, as if we are going to talk about percentage reductions, people do tend to understand it. And perhaps this is where, you know, it's an interesting thing when you talk about sort of risk reduction, and we're sort of trying to give people, we're trying to encourage people to do things which are best for them. Do I willfully inflate, you know, numbers so that people do things like stop their smoking? Maybe I do, you know, it's... I suppose there's a certain art to it. But if we really wanted patients to be concretely understood what the numbers mean, they're best probably not to use relative risk, best to use absolute risk reductions. But even within absolute risk reductions, understand that once you get to small numbers, they are not intuitive. And then sort of using sort of the natural number frequencies, like 1,000 people got this, X number, this happened, X number. I think that's probably the best way of communicating risk. It's an interesting thing, you know, I think within medicine, we talk about NNTs quite a bit, numbers of injury. There's actually a systematic review looking at evidence-based risk communication to patients.
Oh, wow.
And NNTs confuse patients. it lowers their understanding. It worsens their understanding of of risk if you use NNTs to patients. And actually, that kind of makes sense. They're not actually the most intuitive concept, I think, if that's not a concept you sort of work with. I think with doctors, we tend to work with that concept quite a bit. Yeah. So we get it. But you've never really heard about the concept. It is kind of a bit weird, the concept. And yeah, apparently it actually worsens patient understandings. And that was actually a pretty seminal paper for me. I actually stopped using NNTs in describing interventions to people.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point, because I have actually found that. I've not read the paper, but I have found that, and I basically stopped as well, just purely watching people's faces, you know, when I'm saying it. I'm like, okay, there's something not quite happening here. Or looking at the outcomes that happen, because let's say the needed number to treat is 8, which is actually a pretty damn good needed number to treat, right? But it's like the patient's like, wait a minute, are you telling me you're giving 8 people medication and only one of them's getting better? I'm like, yeah, that's really good. And they're like, no, that's terrible. And I'm like, okay, we're just on different levels of understanding here. So to them, it almost looks like we're over-medicalizing and over-treating. But really, it's just a sort of population epidemiological statistic that we're using to convey a value. Yeah. And so if anything, I find it almost does, it's worse for the patient to think in those terms. Like seeing, I think the way you described it before is, you know, if you've got 100 people with heart disease, for example, and 50 people are going to get a heart attack in a year, and you put them on statins, now only 40 people are going to get a heart attack in a year. That's a reduction of, you know, 10% absolute or whatever it is, 20%, 25%, 20%, yeah, relative risk. And then they can go, oh, okay, yeah, all right, maybe that's worth it to me then. So it seems like, or they can say, no, it's not worth it. And obviously that in the end, that's their choice. But I do find that a much better way to explain it.
Yeah. Part of the problem with NNTs as well is that they're a hidden context. They're actually context to NNTs. And one of the most important things is just the baseline rate. Like, let's say that, let's say I've got this magic drug. Okay, magic drug.
We're all looking for it.
Yeah. And if you took it, it will 100% reduce your likelihood of a myocardial infarction. So, you know, if you took it, you will not get a heart attack. But if the baseline risk of getting a heart attack, let's say in 5 years in the tested population is 12.5%, it's 1 in 8, then of course the NNT is going to be 8. If you gave it to the whole population, yeah, the NNT would be 8, because that was actually just the number of people who were going to get the condition.
Yeah.
But you stopped all heart attacks. And so the baseline rate is actually quite important. While let's say you're looking at migraine, for people with chronic migraine, they're going to get the migraine. So so the baseline rate of a migraine for someone who's a chronic migraineur is 100%. It's 1. And so if you took a drug where only 1 in 8 people will get 50% in headache reduction, which is the outcome we really look at, yeah, that NNT of 8 is pretty crap. It's pretty hopeless. So 1 in 8 people. You know, you give 8 people the drug and one person actually reaches the outcome of halving the headaches. That's pretty hopeless. So I think the baseline rate really matters. And I think sometimes in sort of NNT communication, we ignore that context a little bit. Yeah. And I think for patients, they don't really understand that as well.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, I'm not sure a huge number of clinicians fully understand it as well. But the 'cause that's, you know, something I didn't fully appreciate. Like, I haven't thought of it like that before. And so, you know, thinking of the context, as you say, that it's almost like an absolute and relative NNT almost, you know, when you look at it like that. So that's a very good point. Fantastic. All right. Well, is there anything else you sort of have found helpful as sort of pearls when it comes to teaching this or?
Yeah. So I think, you know, for people who are sort of interested in sort of doing some critical appraisal, just practicing, you know, doing critical appraisal and actually looking at evidence. And, you know, I think, you know, for a lot of people starting out, I think they get freaked out by the maths, you know, the statistics that, you know, oh, no, I just don't feel comfortable with statistics. I don't really know what a lot of this means, and who am I to, you know, who am I to say whether it's okay or not? And my sort of my encouragement over that is, when you actually do a critical appraisal of a paper, usually the problem is not because of the statistics. If there is a problem with a paper that will make you use your judgment to qualify or maybe not be able to apply what the paper says to your patients, it's almost always because of a methodological issue. that actually the intervention they described is actually just inapplicable to your local context. So, you know, the frontline intervention might have been the starting of the drug, but actually the patient's also got a whole bunch of other stuff as well. That was part of the intervention. You just can't do that. Mm. Or the nature of the study was that it was intrinsically quite biased. You know, their population do not look like your population. Now, I work in primary care. Well, their population were people recruited to attend a tertiary clinic of some sort. And these were people who had a condition who specifically went there. They're not the same patients as my patients. And so you might think, well, that's actually, those patients are different enough that there's really good reasons to believe that intervention may not be effective or may not behave in the same way. I shouldn't necessarily assume that it should apply. Or there may be, you know, you look at the study and there was a huge dropout rate of the study. And when you look at the dropout, there was a differential dropout. So people who got to intervention dropped out at a different rate to the people who dropped out who were in the control group. And so, who's to say what the actual real effect was when taking into that account? And in terms of what's a big dropout and what's a small dropout, the worksheets from the Center of Evidence-Based Medicine actually describe sort of some rules of thumb around that, so it's quite useful. Mm. And it's often actually about these issues. And within those issues, often you might say, look, it's almost not worth looking at the results anymore. It's not going to change my practice. If I look at the result, it's really more from academic interest rather than something that's going to change what I do with patients. So almost all the problems are at that judgment level, that judgment level of what we know about research, what we know about our patients. That's usually is how you make a determination on whether it's a problem or not. And certainly when looking at sort of doing critical praise of a study, the focus generally should just be on the primary outcome. So because presumably that's what the study is designed around. It's designed around a primary outcome. Pretty much every other outcome, even if they're sort of interesting, they should be seen as somewhat more exploratory because often those outcomes, the experiment wasn't designed around that. Mm-hmm. So I would generally say it's a focus on the primary outcome. What does it actually say? You know, don't forget about the p-value. You know, what's the actual effect size and how imprecise is that effect size? So that might be the confidence interval. And then think about, well, let's look at one end, the extreme end of one end of the confidence interval. Well, if that were true, how important would that be, that effect be? And what about the other extreme? Well, how important would that effect be? Now, if both of those extents, you would think, yeah, that's still pretty good. I would still potentially change my practice because of those effect size. And your goal, you know, the results tell you information that possibly should change your clinical practice. Now, sometimes the nature of the confidence intervals is, you know, if you look at one end, you know, this is a magic drug, you know, it basically cures the condition. You look at the other end of the confidence interval, it suggests the drug should be killing people left, right, and center. That means that the result is really imprecise. We really don't know where the true estimate is in terms of the effect. Mm. And it's interesting, you know, it adds to the evidence base and maybe in the future when other people also research the same question, we'll get a better analysis that gives us a more precise estimate. But at the moment, the result is too imprecise for us to really make a decision on whether or not it's something that should inform my clinical care. And again, mm. that's potentially useful. And again, the p-value, I say generally can be ignored for the most part. It doesn't tell you how true the result is, doesn't tell you how likely the result is true, doesn't tell you how good the study was. It's a confounded number. It really needs to be interpreted within the context of the experiment itself. And really from the analysis perspective, it's the least important bit of the result. The most important bit of the result is what was the actual effect? How imprecise was the effect?
Mm, yeah, that's a really interesting point. So when you're looking at effect, and obviously these are represented by numbers, often, you know, plus something or minus something, but the so you're looking, because often in sort of results, you can see in brackets, they put the range of where this fits into and the probability that it's going to fit into one of those, you know, into that range. And so if that range is a really wide range, then that's in itself probably slightly concerning, especially if that ranges from negative effect to a really good effect. So the average may be little, but It's interesting that you say the p-value doesn't really matter, as you, and that's because it doesn't represent the quality or the methodology of the trial. It simply represents the, well, the probability of their results specifically to that situation. Is that what you're sort of saying?
Yeah, well, the p-values are commonly misunderstood. I think the I have to confess I'm a bit of a maths nerd. So I actually did a qualitative study on p-values last year, looking at how GPs understood the p-values. In fact, you know, in terms of how it's typically presented. So, you know, you get a concluding line in an abstract, you know, drug A is better than drug B, P equals 0.05, so something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to try to understand what people thought that actually meant. And one of the most common ways that that GPs and GP originals reported what they thought it meant was that if P equals 0.05, there's a 95% chance that the result is true, or there's a 5% chance that a result is due to chance, something like that. So mm-hmm. some version of those words. And the important thing is that that common conceptualization of P is completely wrong. That's not what it means at all. P values have absolutely no direct, so the value of the P have no direct relationship with the likelihood of the truth or falsity of any hypothesis in the real world. That's not what it means. Without going, I suppose, technically what P's actually are, because they actually are a little bit complicated, perhaps the best way to think about P is that it tells you something about how incompatible the observed data was. So in terms of the data they actually measured in their experiment, just how incompatible is that, are those results with the assumptions of the null hypothesis, so whatever mm-hmm. the null hypothesis was. And that's probably the way to think about it. So if we assume that the assumptions of the null hypothesis are all true, so that includes the null hypothesis itself, includes the particular statistical models, particular statistical method that is being used to test for differences. The assumptions would be, for example, that the data might be normally distributed if you're using a parametric test. So assuming that all that stuff is true, that is the state of being, that is the state of the world, how weird would our data look like? In that context, so how incompatible is the data? That's all it means. And the data can be really incompatible with that model for lots of reasons, including that actually is true, you know, that null hypothesis actually is false, or maybe you use the wrong statistical test, or maybe it's different, not because of your hypothesis, it's because of the bias that you had in your data as well, which is why it looks really weird. So the p-value just tells us something about incompatibility, but it doesn't actually tell us that, yes, there's a 95% chance that the whole hypothesis is false. It doesn't say that at all.
Oh, that's super interesting. Look, I'm going to admit that you've slightly lost me, but that's okay. I think that's just me being honest. I'm a nerd too, but not in that manner, but in my own way. But that is really interesting. And one thing that reminds me of is the concept of p-hacking, and we really should wrap it up because thank you for your time. But is the p-hacking is the sense that, you know, that anyone can do a trial, especially sponsored funded trials, and then they can go, well, damn, we've got a p-value of 0.2, which is, you know, everyone's going to know that doesn't look very good. So if I just remove that little bit of data and change the endpoints, so the endpoint's no longer mortality, but maybe morbidity. Look, now the p-value is less than 0.05. Yes, that means it. And then so everyone goes, oh, it must be a good trial. And so it's like, no, that's not what it means. It's as you say, the methodology's been changed, the hypothesis has been changed, the endpoints have all been changed just to make that p-value less than 0.05. And it makes the whole thing questionable.
Yes. And I think, you know, this is the, you know, part of the, I think the culture of both sort of research, partly also journals in terms of what people expect to be reported, and having this P equals 0.05 is completely an arbitrary value. And by trying to manipulate things so that we get that number, the problem, of course, is that part of the misconception is that people think that when you get that badge of honor, effectively, that it means it's true. And this is one of the reasons why I personally think that as much as possible, we should just stop paying so much attention to the p-value. It actually doesn't mean a whole lot. Like a p-value of point, like if we think about p as sort of this sort of incompatibly strength of evidence against null hypothesis, like a p of 0.04, say, 0.06, they're practically the same number. You know, which means the strength of evidence against the null hypothesis, it's about the same, you know, practically the same number. And yet on one side of the threshold, people say, oh, you know, it's false. The other side, oh, yeah, you know, good one. It's got a result. Well, they practically are the same, which means they really should be interpreted in almost the same way in terms of our understanding of the results. But no, people do have that dichotomous way of thinking about P's, which is, again, it's actually an erroneous way of thinking about them, but it just exists. So a good way is actually just not to concern yourself too much with the p-value. It doesn't mean a whole lot. And actually look at what results were actually there and how imprecise the results are there. Like a very small p doesn't mean the result is true. It just means that the result as measured is very incompatible with the null hypothesis. So the question is that because the results are true or because the results are biased? And the way you will know whether it's biased is by doing the, you know, having a look at the methodology, using the worksheet, you know, answering some of those specific methodological questions. Because if there's a few big problems there, small p's don't mean anything. It just means that there was a difference, but doesn't tell you why the difference occurred.
Fantastic. Super useful. Thank you so much. And, you know, the bias, we won't go into it, but I'll do another podcast another day about publication bias and all these other sorts of bias that exist, but important to be aware of. Now, just to wrap it up, are there any courses that GPs can do on evidence-based medicine? Are they like, or is it, or does everyone have to go and do an honours and a master's, or are they like a weekend courses?
Look, I think... to be honest, I can't. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure. So, look, definitely, I think
you should start some.
If you're interested, I think there are, you know, good, you know, any sort of good sort of postgraduate program will include the research methods in EBM. There are, I know that GP Synergy registrars now have a course, a sort of online course, which I was lucky enough to be involved in helping develop. That was sort of created by the University of Sydney, University of New South Wales, sorry. The Cochrane collaborations, the Cochrane Library, they actually have an EBM course. You have to do a Google search for it. That's sort of designed, I think, for sort of clinicians and consumers, which go through a bunch of things. It's basically a free online course. It's got a whole bunch of sort of spoken videos. Worthwhile looking at. I did create an EBM course a long time ago, 2011, which is actually still on my website. It's sort of orphaned now. It contains some videos and there's a worksheet to go through. It's getting a bit long in the tooth now, that one, but you know, if people want to look at it, that's there too.
Excellent. Well, that is fantastic. So thank you so much for your time, Michael. Really appreciate it. Really learned a lot as well. Some great tips for me and hopefully everyone else who listens. So thanks again.
No worries. Good having a chat.